Okay, in the first 18 or so verses that we find in James chapter 1, there are a number of lessons that he teaches, principles that he establishes. We've already mentioned the fact that the book itself is a book that consists, to a very large extent, of practical advice for a Christian. One of the most helpful books that we may study because of the practical advice. It's not a particularly deep book theologically, in the sense that there are not difficult concepts that are hard to grasp. This is sound practical advice that he has for those who read his epistle. And I think that beginning in verse 19, going through the end of the chapter, these instructions that we receive fall under that category. We've already, already seen some suggestions, some good pieces of advice, some exhortations given. We're told not to fall into various trials. Verse 2 of the text. Verse 4, let patience have its perfect work. Verse 9, let the lowly brother glory in his exaltation, but the rich in his humiliation. These are, again, just practical, sound pieces of advice, if you want to put it that way. Secondly, these are admonitions. These are things that God expects of us as Christians, and that's certainly the case here in verses 19 through 20. Now, you remember in verse 18, we are told that of his own will, having reference to the Father, of his own will he brought us forth by the word of truth. We are begotten of God through the gospel of Christ for a particular purpose. As Paul said in Ephesians 2, we are his workmanship. Here in verse 20 of the text, verse 18 of the text, we are told that we are a kind of first fruits of his creatures. This is again something that indicates a responsibility on our part to be fruitful. To be active in the work that God would have us to do because or as a result of the blessings that we have received from Him. So I think it is in that context that verse 19 tells us, so then, in other words, this is the conclusion, since we are to be a kind of first fruits of His creatures, so then we are to act in a particular way. This is something in particular that we are to do. And it is stated in verse 19 and 20, so then, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath, for the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. So this is, again, a piece of advice or an admonition that is given. This is something that will instruct us in the best way to live for Christ. And one of the things that should be characteristic of us as Christians is that we are slow to speak, swift to hear, slow to speak, and slow to wrath. So let's talk about that for just a few moments. One of the things that I mentioned is how peculiar it is that the one who normally does the instructions in these matters is the one who's standing up and while talking. So this being slow to speak is something that we have to first understand what is meant by that. When we're told to be slow to speak here, I'm not thinking that it has much to do with teaching at all. It has reference to interaction with one another because we have an escalation that takes place here in this text. There is the idea of wrath that is present here. Be swift to hear, slow to speak, and slow to wrath or slow to anger, because the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. Slow to anger, swift to hear, slow to speak. Have you ever heard a piece of advice that you hear often concerning an angry count to 10, the importance of controlling oneself to be slow to vent any kind of anger that you may receive. We're talking about interaction with one another. How do we conduct ourselves in a situation like that? There are other things that come to mind when you hear the phrase to be swift to hear and slow to speak. It has to do with instruction and gaining wisdom and knowledge. Just to note this, if I'm teaching a class, I am going to explain to you what I've prepared and what I've studied. As I'm doing that, I am imparting the knowledge that I have obtained through my preparation of the lesson. It's one of the reasons why I like a discussion and appreciate when people have studied themselves, because when I'm doing that, all I'm doing is teaching you. I'm not learning anything myself. And I'm talking about the subject matter. I recognize I'm making learning about human nature, but I'm imparting what I've learned. If you are willing to sit and be quiet and listen to what I have to say, then you are going to learn something, perhaps, because you are taking in information. If you're talking, if I'm talking as a teacher, I'm not taking in information, I'm imparting information. So if by its nature, whenever you are talking, you're communicating perhaps something you know or what you desire, what you will, but you're not getting anything back in that sense. Whereas an individual who hears does receive that. That's why, again, I like discussion, because after I've said what I have to say, if someone else has another comment, maybe now I'll learn something I didn't know, or get perhaps a more thorough understanding of a particular passage. So, just in general, the idea of being swift to hear and slow to speak is a good one. The writer of the book of Proverbs talks about having an economy of words to keep quiet and let everyone think that you're a fool instead of opening your mouth and moving all that. We need to be careful with regard to what we say. Be slow to speak. But I think the primary application here, and we would derive that from the context and the involvement of wrath here, is the importance of self-control with regard to our interactions with one another. And I think the primary idea that he has here is there's a problem, a danger that exists, and that is of anger. The danger is anger. And actually, as you go on, you'll note in verse 26 of the same chapter, if anyone among you thinks he's religious and does not bridle his tongue, but he deceives his own heart, and this one's religion is useless. In the third chapter of the book, we'll spend quite a bit of time looking at the first 12 verses when we get to that part. It talks about the tongue. You'll notice in chapter 3 and verse 6 that the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. The tongue is so set among our members that it defiles the whole body. It sets on fire the course of nature, and it is set on fire by hell. So here the writer James is expressing very clearly the danger of the tongue. And I think that it's a recurring theme that goes throughout the text of James, and he's calling them to care in regard to their the use of their tongue. He's asking them to be reticent to rather than be bold to speak and quick to speak and express themselves. Instead, be willing to listen. And again, as we see practically the case, we recognize that it takes two to argue, that often passions are inflamed when individuals are argumentative. They speak quickly, they speak loudly, they speak harshly. And the best thing, as far as being a peacemaker, which we talked about last Wednesday evening, the best thing in maintaining righteousness is be reticent, not to react quickly, not to speak rashly, but rather the only thing we should be fast about is to listen to others. Be swift to hear and slow to speak and slow to anger. So I think it has to do with communication, especially in the area of conflict resolution, of this concept of a conflict that exists, and how are we to react in the midst of this conflict. The applications, again, broad in general with regard to how smart it is, keep your mouth shut, ears open. But I think specifically here in this context, we're talking about the danger of anger. And so the only thing I would add to that is in that statement in verse 20, it says that the wrath of man or the anger of man does not produce the righteousness of God. I was looking at one commentary reading about this, and the commentator made a contrast to explain this idea of the wrath or anger of man does not produce the righteousness of God. And that is the response to the message preached. When you think, for example, of the two individuals or the two groups early on in the history of the church that we hear about who received the gospel message, a very strong message of condemnation with regard to their actions, the Jews on Pentecost and the audience of Stephen. And we've talked often about the fact that the messengers were servants of God. The message was very similar. It was identical with regard to content, but very, very similar in tone. But there were two markedly different responses to the preaching of the gospel. One group repented, and the other group got mad. And what was the response of the ones who repented? Well, the response of those who repented was a final obedience to the gospel, and 3,000 souls that day were saved. The response of those that were angry is that they compounded their sin by murdering Stephen. Anger does not produce righteousness. Never does. Now, there is a situation, and this is that same commentator made this distinction between anger and righteous indignation. And you remember that Jesus was angered in a sense as he witnessed the money changers of the temple. Let no one think that Jesus lost control of his temper, however. What he had was a righteous and appropriate indignation for the sin of those money changers and the monetization of this practice, this circumstance. And what he did was appropriate as he drove the money changers out of the temple. So that was a response that was controlled and appropriate. An individual who becomes angry loses control, and that does not produce righteousness. And so self-control is something that actually James is going to call us to on many occasions here in the text, and this would be an example of it. Whenever conflict arises, how do you react to that conflict? You control yourself. You don't speak rashly. You don't speak quickly. You listen. You control your anger. You do not let it control yourself. Because if a person gets in a circumstance where he allows the anger to gain control, if he, quote, loses his temper, the end result is not righteous, because anger does not produce righteousness. Anger is destructive and sinful. So, that's what I have to say. And now I'm going to be swift here. Does anyone have any comments or questions that they want to add to those two simple verses? Ron, did you have something?
I'm reminded of Jesus saying, you have an ear to hear, let him hear. That means understand. If you don't listen well, we won't understand. I think that has to do with this. So listen well, so that you do understand. This is all referring back to the previous two sections. In contrast of between man who sins and God who is neither variable nor even shadow of variable. So this is also referring back to that. And the conclusion is, if you don't listen, you won't learn.
Anybody else? Yes, Dave.
Of course, we're reading Ephesians 4:26 says, "Be angry, sin not, don't let the sun set on your wrath." So there are times you can be angry, and you don't sin. But one problem I see, some people think the first part of that, some of the church, that to be angry is a commandment, you know. So there are times when, most time we get angry, we do sin, but there are times, especially, I guess we don't sin when we get, maybe the anger is not the right word, but when somebody's teaching error, and you get to the point, you know, that you need to say something about it and all that. It goes on too much that people don't say, and they just let this false teaching go on and don't convict the gainsayer. But anyway.
Yeah, well, that, of course, doesn't have anything to do with that at all. In fact, that is the point that I made at the very beginning when it says to be slow to speak, for example. That's not an indication, a discouragement of teaching or of sharing the gospel or anything like that. And in fact, as you look at the text there in verse 19, it doesn't say don't get angry. And in fact, when I look at the term, anger and wrath perhaps are synonymous. I almost said synonymous for some reason, but it's synonymous. So it says to be sober. It's obvious that anger is an emotion. It's an emotion that comes as a result of provocation. But in this phrase itself, to be slow to wrath, there is an indication there that we have an ability to control it, to work on ourselves so that provocation does not lead to, number one, explosion, but even that provocation does not lead to anger quickly. And what does this take? Well, it takes will, it takes self-control, it takes maturation as a Christian. But it's something that I think is worthy of our consideration. A lot of people have the idea, and you even hear the expressions, this person has a hair trigger on his temper. He's quick tempered. He's an individual that flies off the handle with slight provocation. And when individuals, especially those who are afflicted with this problem, where provocation has that tendency to trigger the anger quickly, they'll have kind of almost a built-in excuse. Well, that's just the way I am, or I can't help it. And that's not true. That is not to say that there are not times that the provocation is sufficient that we will become angry. Or that in those situations that the anger that we feel is something that is inappropriate or sinful, because as Dick indicated in Ephesians chapter 4, was it?
26.
Ephesians 4:26, that the Apostle Paul actually acknowledges this inevitability of anger: be angry and sin not. But there are two things that come to mind. One is that when we become angry, we can still control ourselves. So that anger, if it spills out into a wrathful or unrighteous action, we're still responsible. We're still culpable in that regard. So we don't have an excuse. In fact, I couldn't help it because that's my personality. That's not going to be acceptable to God. And secondly, that we can work to the point where we have the ability to control ourselves better through maturation, through just the determination. I'm not going to let these things get under my skin. I'm not going to let these things provoke me and ruin my day. I'm going to have a better mindset, better approach, a willingness to steel myself against such provocations. And much of this, in any area with regard to temptation, is a matter of will and desire. Yes.
There's two pieces to the vernacular of the English language. Gives us an excuse. I lost my temper, as if it just happened. And a more appropriate way would be to say I gave into my temper. It's not outside our control, but the English language helps us have an excuse on it. And secondly, as you said, thoughts, feelings are not the same as actions, except that if you hate your brother, if you hate somebody, you've already murdered him. So it's a very elementary stage to be able to say, all right, I'm really angry, I'm not going to do anything to show that, and move to that level that a mature Christian has of, I'm not going to let it anger me.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, that's the slow, direct part, and there is that possibility, and I think that's again the way people feel. I can't help being angry, but I'm not going to act on it. Well, that's fine, but actually, you can help being angry in many cases. Again, there are certain situations, circumstances where the provocation rises to the point where anger is an understandable and acceptable response in the sense of be angry and sin not, as Paul said, but it must be a process to where an individual, in order to be the type of person that God says they should be, is slow to that point.
James types the wrath. He's talking about two types. James likes to categorize things into types. That's why he says pure and undefiled religion before God. He's typing religion in that case, because religion in general is a very negative thing in the connotations of the Bible, because religion is things like what the Pharisees do, which are hollow and meaningless. Here he's typing wrath and he says, be slow to wrath. Then he says, for the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. Well, if the wrath of man doesn't produce the righteousness of God, then we want nothing to do with the wrath of man. We don't want to be slow to the wrath of man. We want to never get to the wrath of man. We want to get to the wrath of God, which is the same concept as when Paul says in 2 Corinthians that I'm glad I made you sorry because it was a godly sorrow. He wasn't glad that he gave them any sort of sorrow of man. He was glad that he gave them a sorrow of God, because that sorrow of God was correct and was effective. If you have a sorrow of man, it is not going to be correct and it is not going to produce righteousness of God. If you have a sorrow of God, or I'm sorry, wrath. If you have a wrath of God, then you are going to drive people out of the temple. If you have a wrath of man, you're going to do something inappropriate and sinful.
That's a very good way of explaining that. In fact, we've talked about, I've used this phrase, and sometimes when I do it, I explain what I mean. Whenever you hear of righteous indignation, you'll actually hear that term used in a derogatory way among people in general today. It's righteous indignation. What they mean by that is self-righteous indignation. But the word righteous is good, holy, appropriate, a characteristic of God, becoming indignant or angry at sin, for example. Well, righteous indignation, or this godly wrath, is what was present in Jesus' case. And that, again, from time to time, is appropriate for us as well. But what we're talking about here is something that is without defense and is ultimately destructive. Roger, did you have something to?
Well, I was just looking at 13 again. Verse 13, how they kind of, you were mentioning about people thinking that they were just made the way they are, and they have a short fuse or whatever. And I think I think verse 13 is taking away their excuse.
Yeah.
Let no man say when he's tempted, I'm tempted of God. And you can't say that God made me that way. And there's nothing I can do about it.
Yeah, as Christians, we need to do this. Now, the world's not willing to do this, but we need to recognize, okay, if the Bible defines something as sin, this is a sinful thing. And then an individual comes along and says, I can't help myself. God made me this way. Man, that can't be right. it's self-contradictory, because God doesn't make us or lead us to sin. It's not God's fault. That's what James is saying very clearly there in James 1 and verse 13. Let no one say when he's tempted, I am tempted by God. For God cannot tempt any individual. He cannot himself be tempted by anyone, nor does he tempt any individual anyone. So, that's, and of course that, how many times have you heard that? I can't help it. It's not my fault. Then, or why did God make me this way? Why did God do this to me or allow me to be like this? And in reality, what is an indication is a lack of self-control, a lack of maturity, a lack of willingness to do God's will, and all of those things are without excuse.
I'm not sure people look at being angry as a temptation. Like, I'm tempted to be angry. You might be tempted to
act on
it. You might be tempted to steal something or tempted to, you know, covet something, but anger, I don't know that we think about that as a temptation, but it's a temptation.
And that's sometimes when you see a Christian, a really faithful and mature Christian, and they retain their equanimity despite provocation. And sometimes with an individual who's a mature Christian and really exhibits that self-control, others will look at it and say, how in the world could that person keep calm in this situation, in this circumstance, the way he's being treated this time? And it does have to do with that process of maturing as a Christian, the process of determining to do God's will, of acting appropriately in all circumstances and situations. It is the mastery of the will, of living for Christ, of abiding in the Spirit, as Galatians chapter 5 tells us to do, walk in the Spirit, you shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. But it's something that takes diligent effort and work. You have to grow and mature into this. an individual who has that hair trigger, he's baptized in water the next day, he's still going to have that hair trigger. Now, you may have a determination not to act on it, but it's not something you just want to immediately go away. But as he walks in the Spirit, as he immerses himself in the things of God, as he seeks to cultivate the proper response to temptation, as time progresses, he'll grow stronger and stronger, more capable, more able to do that as a result of such maturation. And that's something that God calls us to. That's right.
Yeah, I draw our attention back to why this subject even arose on this thing. Why the wrath arises, even the term. Go back to verse 2. Count it all joy when you fall into the various trials. Because these people have been scattered abroad by persecution. They have been subjected to some things that can cause wrath.
Sir.
Easy.
Sir.
And so we don't have to lose sight of why these things come up.
Good one.
I would like to say something. You know, it's work on all of our parts. In 1 Corinthians 9 and 27, Paul said himself, he buffeted his body, bringing subjection. Less preaching to others, he would be disqualified, and some say cast away. He recognized himself. Look what Paul did. Paul spread the gospel everywhere he could. But he realized he had to look at himself. And James brings it home to us. When you go down to the fourth chapter and say, all of this brings it to us as an individual. We have to work on ourselves, and we have to think about to see God, the truth. And it helps us, if we buy in the truth, to be Christian. And if we have a problem like this, because I have problem patient, I don't mind people knowing that. If you told me you're going to meet me at 10 o'clock and you was 10:15, you know, okay, the next time you just show up, don't tell me that you're going to meet me. Call me when you get there and I'll be there. But I changed as I grew older, and I did a lot of prayer. My daughter used to tell me all the time, and he would say, oh, Mommy, you lack patience. And I would agree. I said, yeah, I do. But you know, I worked on it. And now I've gotten older, and I'm patient now. I'm much better. I won't say I'm real patient, y'all. But
I'm much, you're getting better.
I'm much better now. But I have to work on myself. And this is one book I really like, because I told you last Wednesday, it causes you to look at self. Then you bring your own body. And one thing I have going, a lot of people were raised in, you won't have a lot of these problems being so angry, too, when you're raised to, you have boundaries and consider the next help. My father always said, Savannah, if you only have a piece of bread, one slice, if anybody comes to you, no matter who it is, and say that they're harming you, give half of it. That's the reason, no matter what I got, if you want, I wouldn't sell a brother, sister, anything. I don't sell nobody nothing anyway. If I can't give it to you, you don't get it. That's the way I feel, but that's the way I was raised. And the one lady back in Maryland, she told me, she said, you know what, our household wasn't raised to respect Hispanics and I told her, I said, well, see, you're opposite from me, because I was raised to love everybody. But as a child of God, lay that aside, and you learn how to love everybody, because you're not going to help unless you love everybody.
Now, all of those things are expressions of self-control, and we're going to find especially as we get into the admonitions of the book, the various admonitions, that this idea of the bridling of the tongue, controlling the anger, that self-control, which is again a process of Christian maturity, is something that is enjoined time and time again in the text.
Okay. We've spent a lot of time discussing 19, and it's a good discussion, I agree with all of it. We're making application of this verse in a broad context. And certainly the things that we're saying are good. And I offer a possibility that James' context is a little bit more confined than that. Because I ask myself when I read that verse, therefore I love rather than let every man be swift to hear. Hear what? Is he talking about interpersonal relationships the way we've been applying it? That me and you talking together? Is he talking about something else? The context here seems to be talking about, keep in mind that James' letter may have been the first book, or our first letter written. Up to this time, all whoever were converted by the spoken word. And the only way that they could hear, come to faith, and repentance, and obedience, is by listening to the word being spoken. He says in verse 18, his own will he brought us forth by the word of truth. Therefore, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear. Hear what? That's the question. Verse 21, and receive with meekness the implanted word. And then the only hearer he talks about in immediate context following that is those that don't hear, or those who hear only the word and aren't doers of the word. I'm thinking that very possibly what you're talking about here is that everyone be swift to hear the word.
Yeah.
Be swift to hear the gospel, be swift to hear what's being preached. And then it's funny because he spoke twice about it. He's not talking about teachers, and he's not. There's got to be teachers, but it's interesting that the only example he uses is going in chapter 3 as a teacher. And the reason why he says, I don't know many of you become teachers, knowing that we're receiving the scripture judgment. Why? Because everyone stumbles in word. You become a teacher and you start speaking things, then you got to be very careful what you say because you can stumble and say the wrong things.
That's right.
Someone said I drove someone away in a sermon that I preached one time because I said something that they didn't like, they didn't agree with. I'm sure this happened to you before. Instead of coming with me and asking for clarification and talking it out, they just left. Left the congregation, they come back, which was a really bad thing. But that's just illustration. You've got to be careful. How did you say things? But I think that's a very good possibility there that what he's talking about is being swift to hear the word, slow to speak or react to the word that you're being heard, that you're hearing. And don't get angry from what you say, because I'm going to tell you, I've got the Spirit, I'm prophesying to you, this is what you've got to do and be. You may not like it, but you need to do that. What do you think?
Well, in actuality, it's an interesting observation that you make, because there are, I don't have enough commentaries, and I don't appeal to the commentaries often enough to know the general consensus is with regard to individuals' worldviews about it. But I do know that there is a disagreement with regard to the extent of the application that can be made here, how broad the context is in that regard. What you say is certainly valid with regard to the context itself in verse 21 as well as verse 18, both statements having reference to the actual preaching of the gospel. In verse 18 it says, of his own will he brought us forth by the word of truth. That's of course the word of preaching. And then in verse 21, therefore lay aside all filthiness and overflow of wickedness, and receive with meekness the implanted word. There are individuals who think that that it has reference more generally and broadly to interpersonal relationships. Based on the statement in verse 19, where it says, so then, as an application of the principle in verse 18, doing good works, or being the first fruits of his creatures. So then, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift here, slow to speak, slow to wrath, as a general principle, as we've made some application, as Dennis has indicated today. If I had the material before me, I would read to you what others are saying as far as the reasoning given. Just to say that some have the tendency to believe that the application is more broad. But having said that, I do want to indicate, as Dennis said, we've talked about a more broad application, and those things are true in general, and that is the case. That the application would be made. I specifically, at the beginning of it, you'll remember, talked about the reaction to the word in the case of the Jews on Pentecost and Stephen, and that certainly is a proper application of the text, regardless, because again, what happens to the gospel preached, the message preached, when the word is received? First of all, it has to be received. It has to be heard.
Verse 20 also, the wrath of man does not produce righteousness of God. What does produce righteousness of God? Word.
Yes. Right. And the proper response to right. that word, which would not be anger. Yes. Okay. All right. Anybody else? Yes, Kat.
And based on this context, verse 2, is it joy when we fall into diverse temptations? Verse 8, don't be double-minded. Verse 12, happy and loved by God, blessed is he that endureth this temptation when he falls into it and doesn't sin. This verse, I find, in verse 20, is talking to us about, this whole book is about works. What do I base my works on? How do I know what to choose? God said, stand outside emotion and base it on wisdom. Whenever we base any of our works or actions, whatever we do, based on emotion, we can get ourselves in trouble. That's how we can most clearly come to sin. And we know rock. And the motion of it came, and he struck the rock, and that kept him from going into the promised land. And if you participate in sports activities, if you let your emotions overcome you, it's going to cloud your talents. You're not going to make good judgments. I think that's how we fall. That's how we stay strong not to sin. Don't face things from emotion. Put them over on another shelf and stay with the wisdom.
Proper response and self-control with regard to these things. Okay. Let's go on and continue in our study in verses 21. Actually, probably verses 21 through 25. There are two things that are mentioned in verses 26 to 27 that might have an impact upon it. But in verses 21 through 25, we have the introduction of this idea of works or obedience clearly made as a contrast to individuals who do not respond correctly or appropriately to the gospel, the will of God proclaimed. He says, therefore, lay aside all filthiness and the overflow of wickedness, and receive with meekness the implanted word which is able to save your souls. But be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. For if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like a man observing his natural face in a mirror. For he observes himself, goes away, immediately forgets what kind of man he was. But he who looks into the perfect law of liberty and continues in it, and is not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work, this one will be blessed in what he does. Again, when you have statements such as these, and it will be commonly seen in the study of James, there will be a lot of don't do this, rather do this type of statements. And a contrast being laid out as to what constitutes inappropriate behavior and action, and then what is appropriate behavior and action. And we've already seen that with regard to the contrast, slow to speak, swift to hear. So here we have another one, and that is lay aside filthiness and receive the implanted word. And whenever I see statements like that, what immediately comes to my mind, is the description given in Galatians chapter 5. I think that's one of the best explanations the Apostle Paul gives concerning the difference between a life that is lived for God and a life that is not lived for God. An individual who allows himself to be involved with the lust of the flesh rather than walking in the Spirit, that individual, of course, will be unacceptable to God. Those who practice such things are not worthy of the kingdom. But those who instead walk in the Spirit, they will not fulfill the lust of the flesh. A contrast is given. Two ways you can go, two choices that can be made. And where you are in standing with God depends upon which choice you make. And that's certainly the case here. We have one possibility. An individual who has embraced, or has as a part of his life, filthiness and overflow of wickedness. Now, the first thing we need to do is explain what that is. By the way, I like overflow of wickedness much better than the King James superfluity of naughtiness. That's a little bit difficult to get around. Superfluity simply means an overflow. It's too much of it. But the word naughty, as we use it today, is a rather weakened term. And I don't think it probably was when it was penned in 1611. We're talking about something where every drop of it is wicked here in this particular case. So the overflow of wickedness, individuals who are characteristically filthy and wicked. But having said that, do keep in mind that that filthiness and wickedness, as the world perceives it and as God perceives it, is far different. We're talking here about those things that are sinful. And many of the things that are sinful in our day and time have been rationalized by individuals to be acceptable, morally acceptable, societally acceptable. And so they're not considered wicked and filthy. You have to be pretty bad today to be filthy and wicked, but that's not what the Bible is saying. So we are to lay aside filthiness and overflow wickedness. We are to not be characterized in our lives by sinful behavior, but instead our lives are to be, this is just a very simple summary of what is being said here. Don't live a life characterized by sin. Instead, live a life that is characterized by righteousness. But the description that he gives of a life characterized by righteousness helps us to understand what type of life that is. It is an individual who receives with meekness the word and does it. That's simple, isn't it? And as you look at the text all the way down to verse 25, that's basically what he's saying. You can live a life that is characterized by the will of self, which brings an individual into sin, which is heinous in the sight of God. It's a horrific thing, being in rebellion to Him, of doing things that God said don't do, of transgressing His law and will, aptly described by James, who doesn't pull any punches in his description, as being filthy and wicked. So a person can live that way. The only other way that the person can live, the contrast, and it's a black and white situation here, is instead of being that kind of person who's caught up in those things, instead what you can do is in effect go to the Word, find out what God's will is, what God wants you to do, how God wants you to be, the kind of person God describes is acceptable to Him. And once you have done that, do it. Read it, learn it, and do it. And he uses a particular illustration to describe it, an individual who would go and would hear, but not do. That's just not enough, because an individual who's that way, who's only hearing the word but not doing the word, he receives these things, then he's deceiving himself. You'll notice in verse 22, he says, be doers of the word, not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. This is self-delusion. Well, what kind of person is a self-deluded person? Well, it's this kind of person. And I just want you I'll just give you an illustration. One of the television shows that is very, very popular in our day and time, I don't know if you've ever watched it, but it's called American Idol, and it's singing. And they're trying to find a very talented individual who's the most talented in this competition, and they're going to give him a recording contract. Well, the very beginning of this television, they have open tryout. Anyone who wants to try to become American Idol. And you've got some really, 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 really bad singers. And the amazing thing about that is some of them, no doubt, are doing it as a joke. But a lot of them think they're really, really good. And they get on the stage and they sing in front of these judges and they make absolutely, totally, utter fools of themselves. And when they're told by a judge saying, "That's the worst thing I've ever heard in my entire life," they're shocked. They cannot believe it. They can't understand how anyone would think that they're not the next American Idol, you know, as far as the competition goes. So they're self-deluded. And I've always wondered to myself how that could possibly be. Have these individuals never sung into a microphone with a recorder on the other end and then push play and listen to themselves? And are they not able to tell that what they're doing and what they hear on the radio are two far different things? You know? But some people, what they do is they forget what they heard. In other words, they had that ability. And immediately, the judge will tell you, go and quit your day job, in effect. And then they go on their way, and 5 minutes later, they're convinced that they're still talented, when it's obvious they're not. And that's what's basically being described about this individual. If I were an ugly man, and I were to look in the mirror and see how ugly a man I am, and I'm denying it, but I'm one that's self-deluded. Look in that mirror. He said, "That's an ugly person right there. That's an ugly man." And then immediately turn away and forget how ugly I am. Forget what manner of man I am. Forget what I look like. And go on my way thinking to myself that I'm not what I am. How in the world can you do that? People do it every day, don't they? People do it every day. And that's what individuals do with regard to the Word. I don't know how many times that I have talked with individuals who have expressed to me how Much they have been benefited by the lesson that I've preached, how uplifted, how helped that they've been by the message proclaimed. And then a week later, you see them doing the exact opposite of what was admonished in the lesson itself. Now there's either hypocrisy there or there's self-delusion. Individuals who have rationalized in some way that this doesn't apply to me. You'll notice the statement there, to receive with meekness, the implanted word, the word meekness there. There is humility that is present. One of the comments that I read in looking at this is that ignorance and self-delusion and conceit go hand in hand. And individuals say that these things that you're talking about, they apply to others. But in some way, because of some rationalization on my part, it doesn't apply to me. It may be that other people can't handle this temptation, but I can handle it. It may be that other people this applies to, but there is an exception on my part. That's conceit. And that's not an individual who is meekly receiving the word, who's recognizing that the message of the gospel has application to him individually. And as it has application to him individually, he has the responsibility to accept it and to do it. And that's the key. That's the key to it all with regard to the instructions we receive from God. God has given us sufficient and appropriate instruction for us to live our lives righteously before Him and be found acceptable in that day. And all that remains is for us to hear it and do it. But so many people hear it and don't. Go ahead, Dennis.
Oh, how they have failed in doing that. James is writing to Christians, to brethren. There are those who say that he's writing to unconverted Jews, the diaspora. Obviously, he's writing to brethren. Verse 18, he says, it's by his own will, he brought us forth by the word of truth. Verse 19, he goes, my beloved brethren. Now, he's speaking to brethren, to Christians. And then verse 21, he's telling brethren, Christians, you and me, lay aside all filthiness and overflow wickedness. If they need to lay it aside, they must still be eat up with it. Wow. That's pretty significant and bears underscoring, because they have not been listening, they have not been obeying, they have not received with meekness the implanted word. They are still in need of salvation. They were saved when they obeyed, but something's gone wrong since then.
There were others that had their hands raised, and we will get to you next time, so just can't remember it, write it down, what you wanted to say. And we'll continue our discussion of verses 21 through 27 next week. Thank you very much for your attention today.